Just ahead of them, a door to the large house opened, and a dozen uniformed pikemen marched out into the street, halted, and turned to face them. The officer in charge came forward and bowed politely.
"Prince Caradar," he greeted Silk. "Her Highness wonders if you would be so good as to stop by the palace."
"You see," Silk said to Geryon. "I told you she knew we were here."
He turned toward the officer.
"Just out of curiosity, Captain, what would you do if I told you that we did not feel like being so good as to stop by the palace?"
"I would probably have to insist," the captain replied.
"I rather thought you might feel that way about it."
"Are we under arrest?" Geryon asked nervously.
"Not precisely, Your Majesty," the captain answered. "Queen Thorin most definitely wishes to speak with you."
He bowed to Belgarath.
"Ancient one," he greeted the old man respectfully.
"I think that if we went around to the side entrance, we would attract less attention."
And he turned and gave his men the order to march.
"He knows who we are?"
Geryon muttered to Silk.
"Naturally," Silk said.
"How are we going to get out of this? Won't Queen Porin just ship us all back to Riva?"
"We will talk to her," Belgarath said. "Porin has got a good sense. I'm sure we can explain this to her."
"Unless Polgara has been issuing ultimatums," Silk added.
"She does that when she gets angry, I've noticed."
"We will see."
Queen Porin was even more radiantly lovely than ever. Her slimness made it obvious that the birth of her first child had already occurred. Motherhood had brought a glow to her face and a look of completion to her eyes. She greeted them fondly as they entered the palace and led them immediately to her private quarters. The little queen's rooms were somehow lacy and feminine, with ruffles on the furniture and soft pink curtains at the windows.
"Where have you been?"
she asked them, as soon as they were alone.
"Polgara is frantic."
Belgarath shrugged. "She'll recover. What is happening in Riva?"
"They are directing the search for you, naturally,"
Porin replied.
"How did you manage to get this far? Every road has been blocked."
"We were ahead of everybody, Auntie dearest," Silk grinned impudently at her. "By the time they started blocking roads, we had already gone through."
"I have asked you not to call me that, Galdar,"
she admonished him. "Oh, forgive me, Your Highness," he said with a bow, though still grinning mockingly.
"You are impossible," she told him.
"But of course I am," he answered. "It's part of my charm."
The queen sighed.
"What am I going to do with all of you now?"
"You are going to let us continue our journey," Belgarath replied calmly. "Oh, we'll argue about it, of course. But in the end, that's the way it will turn out."
She stared at him.
"You did ask, after all. I am sure that you feel better now that you know."
"You are as bad or worse than Keldar,"
she accused. "I have had more practice."
"It is quite out of the question,"
she told him firmly.
"I have strict orders from Polgara to send you all back to Riva."
Belgarath shrugged.
"You will go?"
She seemed surprised.
"No," he replied. "We won't. You said that Polgara gave you strict orders to send us back." "All right. Then I give you strict orders not to. Now, where does that leave us?"
"That is cruel, Belgarath."
"Times are hard. Before we get down to serious squabbling, do you suppose we might have a look at the heir to the throne?" Silk asked. His question was artful.
No new mother could resist the opportunity to show off her infant, and Queen Porin had already turned toward the cradle standing in the corner of the room before she realized that she was being cleverly manipulated.
"You are bad, Keldar," she said reprovingly.
But she nonetheless pulled back the satin coverlet to reveal the baby that had become the absolute center of her life. The Crown Prince of Drasnia was very seriously attempting to put one of his toes into his mouth. With a happy little cry, Porin caught him up in her arms and hugged him. Then she turned him and held him out for them to see.
"Isn't he beautiful?"
she demanded. "Hail, cousin," Silk greeted the baby gravely. "Your timely arrival has ensured that I will be spared the ultimate indignity."
"And what is that supposed to mean?"
Porun asked him suspiciously. "Only that his little pink highness has permanently removed any possibility of my ever ascending the throne," Silk replied. "I would be a very bad king, Porun."
"Drasnia would suffer almost as much as I would if that disaster ever took place. Our Gerigan here is already a better king by accident than I could ever be."
"Oh, dear,"
Porun flushed slightly.
"That completely slipped my mind."
She curtsied somewhat awkwardly, her baby still in her arms.
"Your Majesty,"
she greeted Geryon formally.
"Your Highness,"
Geryon answered with a bow that Aunt Paul had made him practice for hours. Porun laughed her silvery little laugh.
"That does seem so inappropriate."
She put one hand to the back of Geryon's neck, drew his head down, and kissed him warmly. The baby in her other arm cooed.
"Dear Geryon," she said, "you have grown so tall."
There wasn't much he could say to that. The queen studied his face for a moment.
"Many things have happened to you,"
she observed shrewdly.
"You are not the same boy that I knew in Val'Alon."
"He's making progress,"
Belgareth agreed, settling himself into a chair.
"How many spies are listening to us at the moment, Porun?"
"Two that I know of,"
she replied, returning her baby to his cradle. Silk laughed.
"And how many spies are spying on the spies?"
"Oh, several, I would imagine,"
Porun told him.
"If I tried to unravel all of the spying that goes on here, I would never get anything done."
"I'll assume that they're all discreet,"
Belgareth said, with a meaningful glance around at the walls and draperies.
"But of course they are,"
Porun declared, sounding slightly offended.
"We do have standards, you know. Amateurs are never allowed to spy inside of the palace."
"All right. Let's get down to business, then. Is it really going to be necessary for us to go through some long, involved argument about whether or not you're going to try to send us back to Riva?"
She sighed, and then gave a helpless little laugh.
"I suppose not,"
she surrendered.
"You are going to have to give me an excuse to give to Polgara, though."
"Just tell her that we were acting on the instructions contained in the Mrin Codex."
"Are there instructions in the Mrin Codex?"
She sounded surprised.
"There might be," he replied. "Most of it's such unmitigated gibberish that no one can be absolutely sure one way or the other."
"Are you asking me to try to deceive her?"
"No. I'm asking you to let her think that I deceived you. There is a difference."
"A very subtle one, Belgareth."
"It will be all right. She is always ready to believe the worst about me. Anyway, the three of us are on our way to Garog Nadrak. Get word to Polgara that we are going to need a diversion of sorts. Tell her that I said to stop wasting time looking for us, and to mass an army somewhere in the south. Make a lot of noise. I want the Angoraks all to be so busy watching her that they don't have time to look for us."
"What on earth are you going to do in Garog Nadrak?"
Porun asked curiously. Belgareth looked suggestively at the walls behind which the official spies, as well as a few unofficial ones, lurked.
"Polgara will know what we are doing. What's the current situation along the Nadrak border?"
"Tense. It is not hostile yet. But it is a long way from Kortul. The Nadraks don't really want to go to war. If it were not for the Grolums, I honestly think we could persuade them to stay neutral. They would much rather kill Murkos than Drasnians."
Belgareth nodded.
"Pass the word on to your husband that I would like him to keep a fairly tight rein on Unheg," he continued. "Unheg's brilliant, but he is a trifle erratic at times. Rodar is steadier. Tell him that what I want in the south is a diversion. not a general war. Elorn sometimes get over-enthusiastic.
I'll get word to him. When will you start?
Let's leave that a bit tentative. The old man glanced once again at the walls of the Queen's room.
You will stay the night, at least,
she insisted. How could we possibly refuse? Silk asked mockingly. Queen Porin looked at him for a long moment, then sighed.
I guess I should tell you, Keldar, she said very quietly. Your mother is here.
Silk's face blanched. Here?
In the palace?
The queen nodded.
She is in the west wing. I have given her that apartment near the garden that she loves so much.
Silk's hands had begun to tremble visibly, and his face was still ashen.
How long has she been here? He asked in a strained voice.
Several weeks. She came before the baby was born.
How is she?
The same.
The little blonde queen's voice was hushed with sadness.
You will have to see her, you know.
Silk drew in a deep breath and squared his shoulders. His face, however, was still stricken.
There's no avoiding it, I guess,
he said almost to himself.
I might as well get it over with. You will excuse me.
Of course.
He turned and left the room, his face somber.
Doesn't he like his mother? He loves her very much,
the queen replied.
That is why it is so terribly difficult for him. She is blind, fortunately.
Fortunately?
There was a pestilence in western Drasnia about 20 years ago,
Porin explained.
It was a horrible disease, and it left dreadful scars on the faces of the survivors. Prince Keldar's mother had been one of the most beautiful women in Drasnia. We have concealed the truth from her. She does not realize how disfigured her face is. At least, we hope she does not. The meeting between Keldar and his mother, it will be heartbreaking. There is no hint in his voice of what he sees, but his eyes...
She broke off.
Sometimes I think that is why he stays away from Drasnia.
And then she straightened.
I will ring for supper, and something to drink. Keldar usually needs that after he has visited his mother.
It was an hour or more before Silk returned, and he immediately started drinking. He drank grimly, like a man bent on reducing himself to unconsciousness as quickly as possible. It was an uncomfortable evening for Geryon. Queen Porin cared for her infant son, even while keeping a watchful eye on Silk. Belgarath sat silently in a chair, and Silk kept drinking. Finally, pretending a weariness that he did not feel, Geryon went to bed. He had not realized how much he had depended on Silk in the year and a half he had known him. The rat-faced little Drasnian's sardonic humor and towering self-reliance had always been something to cling to. To be sure, Silk had his quirks and peculiarities. He was high-strung, a complex little man, but his unfailing sense of humor and his mental agility had seen them all through some very unpleasant situations. Now, however, all traces of humor and wit were gone, and the little man seemed on the verge of total collapse. The dreadful confrontation toward which they rode seemed all the more perilous now for some reason. Although Silk might not have been able to help him when he finally faced Torak, Geryon had counted on his friend to assist him through the terrible days leading up to that meeting. Now even that slight comfort seemed to have been taken away. Unable to sleep, he tossed and turned for hours. Finally, well past midnight, he rose, pulled his cloak about him, and padded on stockinged feet to see if his friend had made it to bed. Silk had not. He still sat in the same chair. His tankard, unnoticed, had spilled, and he sat with his elbows in a puddle of ale and his face in his hands. Not far away, her face unreadable, sat the weary little blonde queen of Drasnia. As Geryon watched from the doorway, a muffled sound came from between Silk's hands.
with a gentle, almost tender expression, Queen Porin rose, came around the table, and put her arms about his head, drawing him to her. With a despairing cry, Silk clung to her, weeping openly like a hurt child. Queen Porin looked across the little man's shaking head at Geryon. Her face quite clearly revealed that she was aware of Silk's feelings for her. Her look was one of helpless compassion for this man of whom she was fond, but not in the way he wished, and combined with that was a deep sympathy for the suffering his visit with his mother had caused him. Silently, Geryon and the Queen of Drasnia stood looking at each other. Speech was unnecessary. They both understood. When at last Porin did speak, her tone was curiously matter-of-fact.
"I think that you can put him to bed now. Once he is able to cry, the worst is usually over."
The next morning they left the palace and joined an eastbound caravan. The Drasnian moors beyond Bokdor were desolate. The north caravan route wound through low, rolling hills, covered with sparse vegetation and scanty grass. Although it was the middle of spring, there seemed to be a sere quality to the moors, as if the seasons only lightly touched them. The wind, sweeping down from the polar ice, still had the smell of winter in it. Silk rode in silence, his eyes on the ground, though whether from grief or from the after-effects of the ale he had drunk, Geryon could not guess. Belgarath was also quiet, and the three of them rode with only the sound of the harness bells of a Drasnian merchant's mules for companionship. About noon, Silk shook himself and looked around, his eyes finally alert, though still a bit bloodshot.
"Did anybody think to bring something to drink?" he asked.
"Didn't you get enough last night?" Belgarath replied.
"That was for entertainment. What I need now is something therapeutic."
"Water?"
Geryon suggested.
"I am thirsty, Geryon, not dirty."
"Here." Belgarath handed the suffering man a wineskin. "But don't overdo it."
"Trust me," Silk said, taking a long drink.
He shuddered and made a face.
"Where did you buy this?"
he inquired. "It tastes like somebody's been boiling old shoes in it."
"You don't have to drink it."
"No, but I'm afraid I do."
Silk took another drink, then restoppered the wineskin and handed it back. He looked sourly around at the moors.
"Hasn't changed much," he observed.
"Drasnia has very little to recommend it, I'm afraid. It's either too wet or too dry."
He shivered in the chilly wind.
"Are either of you aware of the fact that there is nothing between us and the pole to break the wind but an occasional stray reindeer?"
Geryon began to relax. Silk's sallies and comments grew broader and more outrageous as they rode through the afternoon. By the time the caravan stopped for the night, he seemed to be, almost, his old self again.
Chapter 21. The caravan wound its slow way through the dreary moors of eastern Drasnia, with the sound of mule bells trailing mournfully behind it. Sparse patches of heath, which had but lately begun to bloom with tiny pink flowers, dotted the low rolling hills. The sky had turned cloudy, and the wind, seemingly perpetual, blew steadily out of the north. Geryon found his mood growing as sad and bleak as the moors around him. There was one inescapable fact which he no longer could hide from himself. Each mile, each step, brought him closer to Meloria, and closer to his meeting with Torak. Even the whispered song of the orb, murmuring continually in his ears from the pommel of the great sword strapped to his back, could not reassure him. Torak was a god, invincible, immortal, and Geryon, not even yet full-grown, was quite deliberately trekking to Meloria to seek him out and to fight him to the death. Death was a word Geryon tried very hard not to think about.
It had been a possibility once or twice during their long pursuit of Zedar and the orb, but now it seemed a certainty. He would meet Torak alone. Mandoralan or Barak or Hattar could not come to his aid with their superior skill at swordsmanship. Belgarath or Antpol could not intercede for him with sorcery. Silk would not be able to devise some clever ruse to allow him to escape. Titanic and enraged, the dark god would rush upon him eager for blood. Geryon began to fear sleep, for sleep brought nightmares, which would not go away, and which haunted his days, making each worse than the last. He was afraid. The fear grew worse with each passing day, until the sour taste of it was always in his mouth. More than anything, he wanted to run, but he knew that he could not. Indeed, he did not even know any place where he could run to. There was no place in all the world for him to hide. The gods themselves would seek him out if he tried, and sternly drive him to that awful meeting, which had been fated to take place since the beginning of time. And so it was that, sick with fear, Geryon rode to meet his fate. Belgarath, who was not always asleep when he seemed to doze in his saddle, watched, shrewdly waiting until Geryon's fear had reached its peak before he spoke. Then, one cloudy morning, when the lead-gray sky was as dreary as the moors around them, he pulled his horse in beside Geryon's. "Do you want to talk about it?" he asked calmly.
"What's the point, Grandfather?"
"It might help."
"Nothing's going to help. He's going to kill me."
"If I thought it was that inevitable, I would not have let you start on this journey."
"How can I possibly fight with a god?"
"Bravely," was the unhelpful reply. "You have been brave at some pretty inappropriate times in the past. I don't imagine you've changed all that much."
"I'm so afraid, Grandfather," Geryon confessed, his voice anguished. "I think I know how Mandoralan felt now. The fear is so awful that I can't live with it."
"You are stronger than you think you are. You can live with it, if you have to."
Geryon brooded about that. It did not seem to help much.
"What's he like?"
he asked, suddenly filled with a morbid curiosity.
"Who?"
"Torak."
"Arrogant. I never cared for him much."
"Is he like Tochuk? Or Ashrak?"
"No. They tried to be like him. They didn't succeed, of course, but they tried. If it's any help to you, Torak's probably as much afraid of you as you are of him. He knows who you are. When you meet him, he isn't going to see a Sindarian scullery boy named Geryon. He is going to see Belgeryon, the Raven King. And he is going to see Raven's sword thirsting for his blood. He is also going to see the Orb of Aldur, and that will probably frighten him more than anything."
"When was the first time you met him?"
Geryon suddenly wanted the old man to talk, to tell stories as he had so long ago. Stories somehow always helped. He could lose himself in a story, and for a little while it might make things bearable. Belgarath scratched at his short white beard.
"Let's see. I think the first time was in the Vale. It was a very long time ago. The others had gathered there. Belzedar, Baldin, all the rest. And each of us was involved in his own studies. Our master had withdrawn into his tower with the orb. And sometimes months would pass during which we didn't see him. Then one day a stranger came to us.
He seemed to be about the same height as I, but he walked as if he were 1,000 feet tall. His hair was black, and his skin was very pale. He had, as I remember, greenish-colored eyes. His face was beautiful to the point of being pretty, and his hair looked as if he spent a lot of time combing it. He appeared to be the kind of person who always has a mirror in his pocket.
Did he say anything?
Oh, yes. He came up to us and said, "I would speak with my brother, thy master." And I definitely didn't care for his tone. He spoke as if we were servants. It's a failing he has always had. Still, my master had, after a great deal of trouble, taught me at least a few manners. "I shall tell my master you have come," I told him as politely as I could manage. "That is not needful, Belgarath," he told me in that irritatingly superior tone of his. "My brother knows that I am here."
"How did he know your name, Grandfather?"
Belgarath shrugged. "I never found that out. I assume that my master had communicated with him and the other gods from time to time, and told them about us. At any rate, I led this over-pretty visitor to my master's tower. I didn't bother to speak to him along the way. When we got there, he looked me straight in the face and said, 'A bit of advice for thee, Belgarath, by way of thanks for thy service. Seek not to rise above thyself. It is not thy place to approve or disapprove of me. For thy sake I hope that when next we meet thou wilt remember this and behave in a manner more seemly.' 'Thank you for the advice,' I told him. A bit tartly, I suppose. 'Will you require anything else?' 'Thou art pert, Belgarath,' he said to me. 'Perhaps one day I shall give myself leisure to instruct thee in proper behavior.' And then he went into the tower. As you can see, Torak and I got off on the wrong foot right at the very beginning. I did not care for his attitude, and he didn't care for mine."
"What happened then?"
Geryon's curiosity had begun to quiet the fear somewhat.
"Oh, you know the story. Torak went up into the tower and spoke with Aldur. One thing led to another, and finally Torak struck my master and stole the orb."
The old man's face was bleak.
"The next time I saw him, he was not nearly so pretty,"
he continued with a certain grim satisfaction.
"That was after the orb had burned him, and he had taken to wearing a steel mask to hide the ruins of his face."
Silk had drawn closer and was riding with them, fascinated by the story.
"What did you all do then, after Torak stole the orb, I mean?" "Our master sent us to warn the other gods," Belgarath replied. "I was supposed to find Balar. He was in the north someplace, carousing with his Aelons. Balar was a young god at the time, rather enjoyed the diversions of the young Aelon girls. They used to dream about being visited by him, and he tried to make as many dreams come true as he possibly could. So I've been told."
"I never heard that about him." Silk seemed startled.
Perhaps it's only gossip," Belgarath admitted.
"Did you find him?"
"It took me quite a while. The shape of the land was different then. What is now Algeria stretched all the way to the east, thousands of leagues of open grassland. At first it took the shape of an eagle, but that didn't work out too well."
"It seems quite suitable," Silk observed.
"Heights make me giddy," the old man replied. "And my eyes were continually getting distracted by things on the ground. I kept having this overpowering urge to swoop down and kill things. The character of the forms we assume begin to dominate our thinking after a while, and although the eagle is quite splendid-looking, he's really a very stupid bird. Finally, I gave that idea up and chose the form of the wolf instead. It worked out much better. About the only distraction I encountered was a young she-wolf who was feeling frolicsome. There was a slight tightening about his eyes as he said it, and his voice had a peculiar catch in it. Belgarath, Silk actually sounded shocked. Oh, don't be so quick to jump to conclusions, Silk. I considered the morality of the situation. I realized that being a father is probably all well and good, but that a litter of puppies might prove embarrassing later on. I resisted her advances, even though she persisted in following me all the way to the north, where the bear god dwelt with his Aelons. He broke off and looked out at the gray-green moors, his face unreadable. Geryon knew that there was something the old man was not saying. Something important. Anyway, Belgarath continued, Bela accompanied us back to the Vale, where the other gods had gathered. They held a council, decided that they'd have to make war on Torak and his Angraks. That was the start of it all. The world has never been the same since.
What happened to the wolf?
Geryon asked, trying to pin down his grandfather's peculiar evasion. She stayed with me, Belgarath replied calmly. She used to sit for days on end in my tower watching me. She had a curious turn of mind, and her comments were frequently a trifle disconcerting.
Comments? Silk asked. She could talk.
In the manner of the wolf, you understand. I learned how they speak during our journey together. It is really a rather concise and often quite beautiful language. Wolves can be eloquent, even poetic, once you get used to having them speak to you without words.
How long did she stay with you?
Quite a long time. I remember that I asked her about that once. She answered with another question. It was an irritating habit of hers. She just said, "What is time to a wolf?" I made a few calculations and found out that she had been with me for just over 1,000 years. I was a bit amazed by that, but she seemed indifferent to the fact. "Wolves live as long as they choose to live," was all that she said. Then one day I had to change my form for some reason or another. I forget exactly why. She saw me do it. And that was the end of any peace for me. She just said, "So that's how you do it." And promptly changed herself into a snowy owl. She seemed to take a great delight in startling me. I never knew what shape I'd see when I turned around. She was fondest of the owl, though. A few years after that, she left me. I was rather surprised to find that I missed her. We had been together for a very long time. He broke off, and once again he looked away.
Did you ever see her again?
Belgarath nodded. Oh, she saw to that. Though I didn't know it at the time. I was running an errand for my master somewhere to the north of the Vale, and I came across a small, neatly thatched cottage in a grove of trees by a small river. A woman named Poledra lived in the cottage. A woman with tawny hair and curiously golden eyes. We grew to know each other, and eventually we married. She was Polgara's mother, and Beldaran's.
You were saying that you met the wolf again,
Geryon reminded him. You don't listen too well, Geryon, the old man said, looking directly at his grandson. There was a deep and ancient injury in his eyes,
It hurt so great that Geryon knew it would be there for as long as the old man lived.
You don't mean...
It took me a while to accept it myself, actually. Paledra was very patient and very determined. When she found out that I could not accept her as a mate in the form of a wolf, she simply found a different shape. She got what she wanted in the end.
He sighed then.
Aunt Paul's mother was a wolf?
Geryon was stunned.
No, Geryon,
Baldurath replied calmly.
She was a woman. A very lovely woman. The change of shape is absolute.
But she started out as a wolf?
So?
But
the whole notion was somehow shocking to him.
Don't let your prejudices run away with you, Baldurath told him.
Geryon struggled with the idea. It seemed monstrous somehow.
I'm sorry, he said finally. It's unnatural, no matter what you say.
Geryon, the old man reminded him with a pained look, just about everything we do is unnatural. Moving rocks with your mind is not the most natural thing in the world if you stop and think about it.
But this is different, Geryon protested. Grandfather, you married a wolf, and the wolf had children. How could you do that?
Belgarath sighed and shook his head.
You're a very stubborn boy, Geryon. It seems that you are never going to understand until you have been through the experience. Let's go over behind that hill. I will show you how it's done. There's no point in upsetting the rest of the caravan.
Mind if I come along? Silk asked, his nose twitching with curiosity.
Might not be a bad idea, Belgarath agreed. You can hold the horses. Horses tend to panic in the presence of wolves.
They rode away from the caravan track under the leaden sky and circled around behind a low heath-covered hill.
As this should do,
Belgarath decided, reining in and dismounting in a shallow swale just behind the hill. The swale was covered with new grass, green with spring.
The whole trick is to create the image of the animal in your mind, Belgarath explained, down to the last detail. Then you direct your will inward upon yourself, and then change, fitting yourself into the image.
Geryon frowned, not understanding.
It's going to take too long if I have to explain it in words, Belgarath said. Here, watch. And watch with your mind as well as your eyes.
Unbidden, the shape of the great gray wolf he had seen on occasion before came into Geryon's mind. He could clearly see the gray-shot muzzle and the silver ruff. Then he felt the surge and heard the hollow roaring sound in his mind. For an instant, the image of the wolf curiously mingled with an image of Belgarath himself, as if the two were trying to both occupy the same space. Then Belgarath was gone, and only the wolf remained. Silk whistled, then took a firmer grip on the reins of their startled horses. Belgarath changed back again to an ordinary-looking old man in a rust-brown tunic and gray hooded cloak.
"Do you understand?"
he asked Geryon.
"I think so,"
Geryon replied a bit dubiously.
"Try it. I'll lead you through it, one step at a time."
Geryon started to put a wolf together in his mind.
"And don't forget the toenails,"
Belgarath told him.
"They may not look like much, but they are very important."
Geryon put the toenails in.
"Tail's too short."
Geryon fixed that.
That's about right. "Now, fit yourself into it."
Geryon put his will to it.
"Change," he said.
It seemed almost as if his body had grown somehow fluid, shifting, altering, flowing into the image of the wolf that he had imagined in his mind. When the surge was gone, he sat on his haunches, panting. He felt
very strange. Stand up. Let's have a look at you, Belgareth told him.
Geryon rose and stood on all four paws. His tail felt extremely peculiar.
You made the hind legs a bit too long, Belgareth noted critically.
Geryon started to object that it was the first time he had ever done it, but his voice came out in a peculiar series of whines and yelps.
Oh, stop that, Belgareth growled. You sound like a puppy. Change back.
Geryon did that.
Where do your clothes go?
Silk asked curiously.
They are with us, Belgareth replied. But at the same time they're not. It's kind of hard to explain, actually. Beldin tried to work out exactly where the clothes were once. He seems to think he's got the answer. But I never understood the whole theory. Beldin's quite a bit more intelligent than I am, and his explanations are sometimes a bit exotic. At any rate, when we return to our original shape, our clothing is always just as it was.
Even Geryon's sword? Silk asked. And the orb?
The old man nodded.
Is it not sort of dangerous, having it floating around out there, unattached, so to speak?
It isn't really unattached. It's still there. But at the same time, it's not.
I'll take your word for it, Silk conceded dubiously.
Try it again, Geryon, Belgareth suggested.
Geryon switched back and forth several times until his wolf shape satisfied his grandfather.
Stay with the horses, the old man told Silk. We'll be back in a little bit.
He flickered and shimmered into the great gray wolf.
Let's run for a bit, he said to Geryon.
The meaning of what he said was conveyed directly from his mind to Geryon's, aided only slightly by expressions and positions of his head and ears, and a few brief barking sounds. Geryon suddenly understood why the bond of the pack was so strong in wolves. Quite literally, they inhabited each other's minds. What one saw, they all saw. What one felt, they all felt.
Where do we run to?
Geryon asked, not really surprised at how easily the speech of wolves came to him.
No place in particular. I just need to stretch out a few kinks.
And the gray wolf bounded away with astonishing speed. The tail was a definite problem at first. Geryon kept forgetting that it was there, and its swishing back and forth kept jerking him off balance. By the time he got the hang of it, the old wolf was far out ahead of him on the gray-green moors. After a while, however, Geryon found himself literally flying across the ground. His paws scarcely seemed to touch the earth as he bunched and stretched his body in great bounds. He marveled at the economy of the running gait of the wolf. He ran not with his legs alone, but with his entire body. He became quite certain that, if need be, he could run for days without tiring. The rolling moors were different somehow. What had seemed as desolate and empty as the dead sky overhead was suddenly teeming with life. There were mice and burrowing squirrels in scrubby brown thickets. Rabbits, petrified with fright, watched him as he loped by with his toenails digging into the springy turf. Silently he exulted in the strength and freedom of his new body. He was the lord of the plain, and all creatures gave way to him. And then he was not alone. Another wolf ran beside him, a strangely insubstantial-looking wolf that seemed to have a bluish flickering light playing about her.
"And how far will you run?" she asked him in the manner of wolves.
"We can stop if you'd like," Geryon replied politely, dropping back into a lope and then a trot.
"It is easier to talk if one is not running," she agreed.
She stopped and dropped to her haunches. Geryon also stopped.
"You're Poledra, aren't you?"
He asked it very directly, not yet accustomed to the subtleties of the language of wolves.
"Wolves have no need of names," she sniffed. "He used to worry about that, too."
It was not exactly like the voice that had been in his mind since his childhood. He didn't actually hear her, but instead he seemed to know exactly what she wanted to say to him.
"Grandfather, you mean? Who else? Men seem to have a need to classify things, put names on them. I think they overlook some very important things that way. How is it that you are here? Aren't you, well, dead, you mean? Oh, don't be afraid of the word. It is only a word, after all. I suppose I am, though. It doesn't really feel all that much different. Doesn't somebody have to do something to bring you back? Like what Aunt Paul did that time when we were fighting with Grohl in the mountains of Olgo? It is not entirely necessary. I can be summoned that way, but I can manage it myself if I have to.
She looked at him quizzically.
You're really confused by all of this, aren't you? All of what? Everything. Who you are, who we are, what you have to do. A little. Let me see if I can explain it. Take him, for instance. I never really saw him as a man, you know. There is something decidedly wolfish about him. I always rather thought that his being born in man shape had been a mistake of some kind. Maybe it was because of what he had to do. The shape doesn't really matter, though. It doesn't. Did you really think it did? She almost seemed to laugh. Here, let me show you. Let's change.
She shimmered into air and was standing before him then in the form of a tawny-haired woman with golden eyes. Her gown was a very plain one, and brown. Geryon shrugged himself back into his natural form.
"Am I really any different, Belgarion?" she asked him. "Am I not who I am, whether as wolf, or owl, or woman?"
And then he understood.
"May I call you grandmother?"
he asked her, a bit embarrassed.
"If it makes you happy," she replied. "It is a bit inaccurate, though. I know, but I feel a little more comfortable with it. Have you finally accepted who you are? I don't have much choice, do I? But you are afraid of it. And what you have to do, is that it?"
He nodded mutely. "You are not going to be alone, you know." He looked at her sharply.
"I thought the Codex said..."
"The Codex does not really say everything that is involved. Your meeting with Torak will be the coming together of two enormous opposing forces. The two of you are really just the representatives of those forces. There will be so much power involved in your meeting that you and Torak will be almost incidental to what's really happening."
"Well, why couldn't someone else do it then? Somebody better suited to it."
"I said almost incidental. It has to be you, and it's always been Torak," she said firmly. "You are the channels through which the forces will collide. When it happens, I think you'll be surprised at how easy it all is."
"Am I going to win?"
"I don't know. The universe itself doesn't know. That's why you have to meet him. If we knew how it would turn out, the meeting would not be necessary."
She looked around.
"Belgoroth's coming back."
"I'll have to leave you now."
"Why?" "My presence pains him more than you could ever know."
"Because..."
he broke off, not knowing how to say it. "We were closer than others, and we were together for a very long time.
Sometimes I wish that he could understand that we haven't really been separated. But perhaps it is too early."
"It's been 3,000 years, Grandmother."
"What is time to a wolf?"
she asked cryptically.
"The mating of wolves is permanent. And the grief caused by separation is also permanent. Perhaps some day.
Her voice trailed off wistfully. Then she sighed.
As soon as I leave, change back again. Belgarath will want you to hunt with him. It is a sort of formality. You will understand when you are back in the shape of a wolf.
Geryon nodded and began to form the image of the wolf in his mind.
One other thing, Belgarion.
Yes, grandmother.
I do love you, you know.
I love you too, grandmother.
And then she was gone. Geryon sighed and changed himself back into a wolf. And then he went out from that place to join Belgarath in the hunt. Part 4. The Raven Queen. Chapter 22. The Princess Tenedra was in a thoughtful, even pensive mood. Much as she had enjoyed the turmoil her periodic outbursts of temper had caused, she rather regretfully concluded that it was probably time to put them aside and make peace with Geryon. They were going to be married, after all, and there was no real point in upsetting him any more than absolutely necessary. Her tantrums had established the fact that although he might outrank her, she would not enter the marriage as his inferior, and that was really all she had wanted anyway. On the whole, the prospect of being married to Geryon was not nearly as unpleasant as she pretended. She did love him, after all, and now that he understood exactly how things were going to stand between them, everything was likely to be quite satisfactory. She decided to find him that very day and make peace with him. The largest part of her attention that spring morning had been taken up by a book on protocol and a chart she was carefully drawing up. As Imperial Princess of Tolnedra and Queen of Reva, she would, of course, absolutely outrank every Grand Duchess of every house in the Empire. She was also fairly sure that she outranked Queen Achlina of Cherek and Queen Silar of Agaria. Maia Serena's status as co-ruler of Arendia raised some problems, however. It was entirely possible that she and Maia Serena were equals. Tenedra made a note on a scrap of parchment, reminding herself to have Ambassador Valgon direct an inquiry to the chief of protocol in Tolhanath concerning the matter. She felt a nice little glow as she surveyed her chart. With the exception of Lady Pulgara and the motherly little Queen Layla of Sundaria, to whom everyone deferred because she was such a dear, Tenedra concluded that she would in fact outrank or at least equal every noble lady in the West. Suddenly, there was a shattering thunderclap so violent that it shook the very walls of the citadel. Startled, Tenedra glanced at the window. It was a bright, sunny morning. How could there be thunder? Another rending crash ripped the silence, and there was a frightened babble in the halls. Impatiently, the princess picked up a small silver bell and rang for her maid.
"Go see what's happening,"
she instructed the girl, and returned to her study of the chart she had drawn. But there was another thunderous crash, and even more shouting and confusion in the corridor outside. It was impossible. How could she concentrate with all of that noise going on? Irritably, she rose and went to the door. People were running, actually fleeing. Just down the hall, Queen Layla of Sundaria bolted from the door of Lady Polgara's private apartment, her eyes wide with terror, and her crown very nearly falling off.
"What is the matter, Your Majesty?"
Tenedra demanded of the little queen.
"It's Polgara,"
Queen Layla gasped, stumbling in her haste to escape.
"She's destroying everything in sight."
"Lady Polgara?"
Another deafening crash sent the little queen reeling, and she clung to Tenedra in terror.
"Please, Tenedra, find out what's wrong. Make her stop before she shakes down the entire fortress."
"Me?
Well, she will listen to you. She loves you. Make her stop."
Without pausing to consider the possible danger, Tenedra went quickly to Lady Polgara's door and glanced inside. The apartment was a total shambles.
Furniture was overturned, wall hangings had been ripped down, the windows were shattered, and the air was full of smoke. Tenedra had thrown enough tantrums in her own life to appreciate artistry when she saw it. But the disaster inside Polgara's apartment was so absolute that it went beyond art into the realms of natural catastrophe. Lady Polgara herself stood, wild-eyed and disheveled, in the center of the room, cursing incoherently in a dozen languages at once. In one hand she held a crumpled sheet of parchment. Her other hand was raised like a claw before her, half-clenched about an incandescent mass of blazing energy that seemed to have summoned out of air itself, and which she now fed with her own fury. The princess stood in awe as Polgara began a fresh tirade. The dreadful cursing began in a low contralto and rose in an awful crescendo into the upper registers and beyond. As she reached the limits of her voice, she began slashing the air with the blazing mass in her hand, punctuating each curse with a crackling burst of raw energy that sizzled from between her fingers like a bolt of lightning to shatter whatever her eyes fell upon. With a series of vile oaths, she detonated 6 teacups in a row into shards. Then, quite methodically, she went back down the line, exploding the saucers upon which they had sat. Almost as an afterthought, she blew the table into splinters. Tenedra heard a strangled gasp directly behind her. King Anheg, the blood drained from his face, looked once through the door, then turned and ran.
"Lady Polgara,"
Tenedra remonstrated to the sorceress, trying not so much to reason with her as to minimize the destruction. Polgara shattered 4 priceless vases, standing on the mantelpiece with 4 precisely separate explosions. Outside the window, the bright spring morning vanished as if the sun had suddenly been extinguished, and there was a sullen rumble of thunder that Tenedra prayed devoutly was natural.
"Whatever is the matter?"
the princess asked, hoping to draw the enraged sorceress into explanation rather than more curses. It was the curses that had to be headed off. Polgara seemed to have a deep-seated need to emphasize her oaths with explosions. Polgara, however, did not reply. Instead, she merely threw the parchment at Tenedra, turned and blew a marble statue into fine white gravel. Wild-eyed, she wheeled about, looking for something else to break, but there was very little left in the smoking room that had not already been reduced to rubble.
"No!"
Tenedra cried out sharply, as the raging woman's eyes fell on the exquisite crystal wren Geryon had given to her. The princess knew that Polgara valued the glass bird more than anything else she possessed, and she leaped forward to protect the delicate piece.
"Get it!"
Polgara snarled at her from between clenched teeth.
"Take it out of my sight!"
Her eyes burned with a terrible need to destroy something else. She spun and hurled the incandescent ball of fire she had wielded out through the shattered window. The explosion, when it burst in the suddenly murky air outside, was ghastly. With her fists clenched tightly at her sides, she raised her distorted face and began to curse again. From roiling black clouds that had suddenly appeared out of nowhere, shattering bolts of lightning began to rain down on the island. No longer satisfied with localized destruction, Polgara expanded her rage to rake the isle and the sea of winds with sizzling fire and ear-splitting thunder. Then, with a dreadful intensity, she raised one fist and suddenly opened it. The downpour of rain, she called, was beyond belief. Her glittering eyes narrowed, and she raised her other fist. The rain instantly turned to hail, great jagged chunks of ice that crashed and splintered against the rocks to fill the air with flying fragments and thick steam. Tenedra caught up the wren, stooped to grab the rumpled piece of parchment from the floor, then fled. King Anheg poked his frightened face from around a corner. "Can't you stop her?" he demanded in a shaking voice.
"Nothing can stop her, Your Majesty."
"Anheg, get in here!"
Polgara's voice rang above the thunder and the crashing deluge of hail that shook the citadel.
"Oh, Balor," King Anheg muttered devoutly, casting his eyes skyward even as he hurried toward Polgara's door.
"Get word to Val Alorn immediately," she commanded him. "My father, Silk, and Geryon slipped out of the citadel last night. Get your fleet out and bring them back. I do not care if you have to take the world apart stone by stone. Find them and bring them back."
"Polgara, I..." the King of Kerik faltered.
"Don't stand there gaping like an idiot. Move!"
Carefully, almost with a studied calm, the Princess Tenedra handed the glass wren to her frightened maid.
"Put this someplace safe," she said.
Then she turned and went back to the center of the storm.
"What was that you just said?"
she asked Polgara in a level voice.
"My idiot father, Geryon, and that disgusting thief decided last night to go off on their own,"
Polgara replied in an icy voice, made even more terrible by the superhuman control that held it in.
"They did what?"
Tenedra asked.
"They left. They sneaked away during the night." "Then you must go after them."
"I can't, Tenedra," Polgara spoke as if explaining something to a child.
"Someone has to stay here. There are too many things here that could go wrong. He knows that. He did it deliberately. He has trapped me here." "Geryon?" "No, you silly girl. My father."
And Polgara began cursing again, each oath punctuated with a crash of thunder. Tenedra, however, scarcely heard her. She looked around. There was really nothing left to break in here.
"You will excuse me, I hope?" she said.
Then she turned, went back to her own rooms, and began breaking everything she could lay her hands on, screeching all the while like a Kamar fishwife. Their separate rages lasted for several hours, and they rather carefully avoided each other during this period. Some emotions needed to be shared, but insane fury was not one of those. Eventually, Tenedra felt she had exhausted the possibilities of her extended outburst, and she settled into the icy calm of one who has been mortally insulted. No matter what faces his illiterate note put on the matter, it would be at the very most a week before the entire world knew that Geryon had jilted her. The flight of her reluctant bridegroom would become a universal joke. It was absolutely intolerable. She would meet the world, however, with a lifted chin and an imperious gaze. However she might weep and storm and rage in private, the face she presented to the world would betray no hint of how deeply she had been injured. All that was left for her was her pride, and she would never abandon that. The Lady Polgara, however, seemed to feel no need for such imperial reserve. Once her initial fury had subsided to the degree that she allowed her private thunderstorm to pass, a few hardy souls assumed that the worst of it was over. The Earl of Trelheim went to her in an attempt to mollify her. He left her apartment moments later at a run, with her crackling vituperation sizzling in the air about his ears. Barak was pale and shaken when he reported back to the others.
"Don't go near her," he advised in a frightened voice. "Do whatever she says as quickly as you can. Stay absolutely out of her sight."
"Isn't she calming down at all?" King Rodar asked.
"She's finished breaking the furniture," Barak replied. "I think she's getting ready to start on people."
Thereafter, each time Polgara emerged from her apartment, the warning spread instantly, and the halls of Irongrip's citadel emptied. Her commands, delivered usually by her maid, were all variations of the initial orders that she had given to King Anheg. They were to find the vagrant trio and bring them back to face her. In the days that followed,
Princess Tenedra's first rage settled into a sort of peevishness that made people avoid her almost as much as they avoided Polgara. All but gentle Adara, who endured the tiny girl's outbursts with a calm patience. The two of them spent most of their time sitting in the garden adjoining the royal apartments, where Tenedra could give vent to her emotions without fear of being overheard. It was 5 days after Geryon and the others had left before Tenedra discovered the full implications of their departure. The day was warm. Spring came eventually, even to a bleak place like Reva, and the small bit of lawn in the center of the garden was a lush green. Pink, blue, and flaming red flowers nodded in their beds as bright yellow bees industriously carried kisses from blossom to blossom. Tenedra, however, did not want to think about kisses. Dressed in her favorite pale green dryad tunic, she bit rather savagely at an unoffending lock of hair and spoke to the patient Adara at length about the inconstancy of men. It was about mid-afternoon when Queen Layla of Sindaria found them there.
"Oh, there you are,"
the plump little queen bubbled at them. As always, her crown was a little awry.
"We've been looking all over for you." "Why?"
was Sinidra's somewhat ungracious reply. Queen Layla stopped and looked critically at the princess.
"My, aren't we cross today? Just what is your problem, Tenedra? You've barely been civil for days now."
Tenedra caught Adara's warning look to the queen, and that irritated her all the more. Her response was chilly.
"I am finding the experience of being jilted to be just a bit annoying, Your Highness."
Queen Layla's sunny face hardened.
"Would you excuse us, Adara?"
she asked.
"Of course, Your Highness,"
Adara replied, rising quickly.
"I'll be inside, Tenedra,"
she said, and went gracefully out of the garden. Queen Layla waited until the girl was out of earshot, then sat down on a marble bench.
"Come here, Tenedra,"
she said firmly. The princess looked at the motherly little woman, a bit startled by the iron in her voice. Obediently, she went to the bench and sat.
"You really should stop interpreting everything that happens in the world as a personal insult, you know,"
Layla told her.
"That's a very unbecoming habit. What Geryon, Belgareth, and Keldor did has absolutely nothing to do with you."
She looked sternly at Tenedra.
"Do you know anything at all about the prophecy?"
"I have heard it,"
Tenedra sulked.
"Tonerans don't really believe in that sort of thing."
"Well, then, that's probably the problem. I want you to listen very carefully, Tenedra. You may not believe, but you will understand."
The queen thought for a moment.
"Why, the prophecy clearly states that when the Raven King returns, Torak will awaken."
"Torak? Well, that's nonsense. Torak is dead."
"Don't interrupt, dear,"
Layla told her.
"You've traveled with them for all that time, and you still don't understand. For a little girl who seems so bright, you are remarkably dense."
Tenedra flushed at that.
"Torak is a god, Tenedra,"
Layla continued.
"He's asleep, not dead. He did not die at Vomimbre, much as some people might like to think he did. The instant that Geryon touched the orb, Torak began to stir. Haven't you ever wondered why Polgara insisted that Arend carry the orb back from Rakdol? Geryon could have carried it just as easily, you know."
Tenedra had not thought of that.
"But if Geryon had touched it, still on Angrak's soil and without his sword, Torak might very well have jumped up and gone after him immediately, and Geryon would have been killed."
"Killed?"
Tenedra gasped.
"Of course, dear. That's what this is all about. The prophecy says that Torak and the Raven King will eventually meet, and that in their meeting shall be decided the fate of mankind."
"Geryon?"
Tenedra exclaimed, stunned and disbelieving.
"But surely you're not serious?"
"I've never been more serious in my life, child. Geryon has to fight Torak to the death.
to decide the fate of the world. Now do you understand? That's why Belgareth and Geldar and Geryon left Rava so suddenly. They're on their way to Meloria, so that Geryon can fight Torak. He could have taken an army with him, but he knew that would only cause needless death. That's why the three of them went alone. Now, don't you think it's time that you grew up just a little bit?
Tenedra was greatly subdued after her conversation with Queen Lila. For perhaps the first time in her life she began to think more about someone else than she did about herself. Oh, she worried constantly about Geryon, and at night she had dreadful nightmares about hideous things that could happen to him. To make matters worse, there seemed to be a persistent buzzing in her ears that was at times quite maddening. It was rather like the sound of voices coming from a long way off, voices that verged just on the edge of being understandable, but never quite were. The buzzing sound, coupled with her anxiety about Geryon, made her moody and frequently short-tempered. Even Adara began to avoid her. The irritating sound in her ears continued for several days before she discovered, quite by accident, the significance of it. The weather on the Isle of the Winds was never really very good, and spring was a particularly unpredictable time of year. A series of storms, following one after another in dreary progression, lashed at the rocky coast, and nasty little rain squalls swept the city and the island. One somber, rainy morning, the princess sat in her chambers looking glumly out the window at the soggy garden. The fire, which crackled on her hearth, did little to warm her mood. After a while she sighed, and for want of anything better to do, she sat at her dressing table and began to brush her hair. The silver flicker at her throat distracted her eye momentarily as she looked at herself in the mirror. It was the medallion Geryon had given her just after her birthday. She had, by now, grown accustomed to it being there, though the fact that she could not take it off caused her periodic fits of anger even still. Without actually thinking about it, she stopped brushing and touched the amulet with her fingertips.
"But we can't do a thing until the Arryns and the Tolnedryns are fully mobilized." It was the voice of King Rhodor of Thrasnia.
Tenedra started and turned quickly, wondering why the portly monarch had entered her room. As soon as she removed her fingers from the silver amulet, the voice stopped. Tenedra looked around, puzzled. She frowned and touched the amulet again.
"No, no," another voice said. "You don't add the spices until after it starts to boil."
Tenedra again removed her fingertips from the talisman at her throat, and that voice, too, stopped abruptly. Fascinated, she touched it for the third time.
"You make up the bed,
and I'll straighten up. We'll have to hurry. The Queen of Kerik might come back at any minute."
Wonderingly, the princess touched the amulet again, and again. Her ears ranged randomly through the citadel.
"The fire's too hot. This iron will scorch anything it touches."
Then she heard a snatch of whispered conversation.
"What if somebody comes?"
"Nobody's going to come,"
the young man's voice, which replied, had a peculiar wheedling quality.
"We're all safe, cozy here. And I really do love you."
Tenedra quickly jerked her fingers from the amulet, blushing furiously. At first, there was no direction to it. But as the princess experimented, she gradually learned to focus this peculiar phenomenon. After a couple of hours of intense concentration, she found that she could skim rapidly through all of the talking that was going on in a given quarter of the citadel until she found a conversation that interested her. In the process, she learned many secrets, some very interesting, some not very nice. She knew that she should feel guilty about her surreptitious eavesdropping, but for some reason she did not.
"Thy reasoning is sound, Your Majesty,"
it was Mandarallan's voice.
King Coradulan is committed to the cause, though it will take some weeks for his call to arms to gather the forces of Orendia. Our major concern must be the position the Emperor will take in the affair. Without allegiance, our situation is perilous.
Ranbarun has no choice in the matter, King Anheg declared. He is bound by the provisions of the Accords of Omimbre.
Brand, the Riven Warder, cleared his throat.
I don't think it's that simple, Your Majesty, he said quietly in his deep voice. The Accords state that the kingdoms of the West must respond to a call from the Riven King, and Belgarion is not here to issue that call.
We are acting in his behalf, King Kohag asserted.
The problem lies in convincing Ranbarun of that, Rodar pointed out.
I know the Tol Nedrans. They'll have whole battalions of legal experts working on the Accords. Unless Belgarion himself meets Ranbarun face to face and issues his command in person, the Emperor will take the position that he is not legally bound to join us. The Raven King is the only one who can issue a call to war.
Sinedra let her fingertips drop from the amulet at her throat. An idea was beginning to take shape in her mind. It was an exciting idea, but she was not at all certain that she could bring it off. Elorn, she knew, were stubborn and reluctant to accept any new ideas. She quickly laid aside her hairbrush and went to a small chest standing against the wall near the window. She opened the chest and began rummaging through it. After a moment, she found the tightly rolled parchment she had been seeking. She unrolled it and read through it quickly until she found the passage she wanted. She read it carefully, several times. It seemed to say what she wanted it to say. She considered the idea throughout the rest of the day, the possibility that anyone might succeed in catching up with Geryon and stopping him was remote, to say the very least. Belgarath and Prince Keldar were too skilled at evasion to allow themselves to be easily caught. Chasing them was simply a waste of time. Since Polgara was not yet rational enough to see things in this light, it fell to Tenedra to take immediate steps to minimize Geryon's danger once he had entered the lands of the Angrax. All she had to do now was to convince the Elorn kings that she was the logical one to take those steps. It was still raining the next morning, and she rose early to make her preparations. She must, of course, look positively regal. Her choice of an emerald velvet gown and matching cape was artful. She knew that she was stunning in green, and her circlet of gold oak leaves was enough like a crown to convey the right suggestion. She was glad she had waited until morning. Men were easier to deal with in the morning, she had discovered. They would fight her at first, and she wanted the idea implanted in their minds before they were fully awake.